Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We're glad you're with us this afternoon. In studio with me is Lafayette Mayor Tony Rzeborski, and we'd love to have your questions during our show today. You can call those in to us at 496-1999. You can send an email to ask@wbaa.org, or you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, you and I saw each other just kind of in passing the other day at the first home game of the Lafayette Aviators. It's got to be something that you're excited about, something you've been working on for a while.
It is. You know, it was a great opening night. A lot of people, 1,463 people were at the game. I think everybody had a fantastic time. It's a great amenity that we were able to bring to the community. A lot of people worked on that to make that a reality, and MKE Sports have been great to work with. I think the community is really embracing the team. I was happy with the entertainment that they did in between different innings, and I think people really, really enjoyed it. So we want to encourage the community to get behind the Aviators and everybody come to the games. And like I said, we don't need everybody to come to every game. We just need everybody to come to one game, and we'll have a great season for them. Stan, you know, you and I talked a little bit that you're hosting a player, and we certainly appreciate you guys getting involved. That's what we really need, the community getting involved behind the team.
I just I got here into work the following day, and people said to me, "Did the mayor really fly in on a helicopter into center field?" And I'm like, "Yes, he sure did."
Yeah.
How did that come to be?
Well, MKE Sports took care of that. So yeah, just for your listeners, I've only had a couple questions, but there were no tax dollars used in that helicopter ride, and the city did not buy a helicopter. So we'll just put those rumors to rest right now. But they arranged that, and we left from over at Purdue, and the crew was very gracious. They were nice enough to leave a little early, kind of let me fly over the city and look at the city from above. And then with the name, the Aviators and all that, that we thought it'd be a kind of a neat way to bring in the game ball. And really kind of a special night with the first pitch, with the creating the past, the present, and the future. You know, we really wanted to make it a real community event, get the team behind the community behind the team, and just get people really excited. And I think it was a great night.
Let's move on to some questions that have come in since your last appearance on the show from our listeners. Sean has written in and said, with the success of the Matchbox studio, has anyone thought about exploring a maker space in Lafayette? In other words, one with power tools, 3D printers, CNC machines, other tools, things like that.
Well, yes. Matchbox has been extremely successful. We have over 220 members right now. I sit on the Matchbox committee, management committee, and we have begun those initial discussions. You know, there's a small maker space in Matchbox right now that has a 3D printer, some small tools that you can use to do some prototyping. So we have a small space in the back of Matchbox currently. We don't have a large maker space like that as been described, but it's certainly part of the plan going forward to continue to evaluate that. I mean, I think everybody would certainly understand that we had to get started. You never know for sure how these things are going to take off, but it's exceeded everyone's expectations after 2 years. And so that next level of development is something that we'll consider. You have to take in the financial considerations, operational considerations. We'd obviously have to buy or acquire another structure that would hopefully be close to Matchbox to be able to do that, because Matchbox is full, and we're doing great. So certainly those discussions are taking place. That is on our priority list to do, but we want to do everything we do down there with a couple things in mind: doing the right things for the members, ensuring controlled or orderly growth that we can financially handle. And so we'll take those steps with those principles in mind. But yes, we want it to continue to grow, and we want to provide some of those options.
Another question comes in from Tom, who says, "I walk the Munger Greenbush Trail almost every day and love it. While I walk, I pick up trash," he says, "usually 10 to 15 pieces a day. Would it be possible to have more trash receptacles placed along the trail? From my observations, there are two prime places," he says, "where new ones should be placed, near the soccer field, behind Glen Acres School, and by the pond where many people fish. He says, I believe most people will take care of their trash if a receptacle is nearby. Ideally, the trail could use 5 or 6 additional receptacles, but these two would be a good start." Something you're thinking about?
Well, you know, we'll give that some thought. I walk that trail almost daily also and pick up trash, and so I certainly understand what he means. There are numerous trash cans in Munger Park, and then a few strategically located along the piece of the trail that runs right there from the park over to Creasy Lane. There aren't any on the piece that go from Greenbush up to the park. And, you know, we could take a look at that. You know, that becomes a question. Do we start doing that on every trail in Lafayette, putting so many trash cans out like that? That'd become quite an expense, and then you have to get them all emptied if they do fill up. You know, we'd really like to encourage people to just carry that trash to the next receptacle, which around the Munger Park area, whether you come in off Union or you come off Greenbush, there's several trash cans in that middle section there. So it's certainly, if there's a couple strategic spots that we could look at that might really make a difference, we would consider doing that. But you have to be careful. Everything you do like that, there is ongoing maintenance expense. And, you know, I'm not so sure that trash, because I actually live very close to there, is actually people along the trail that's walking the trail dropping that, or if that's actually people throwing stuff out their car window as they're going down Greenbush Street and some of that blows around and stuff, or going down Shenandoah. But we'll certainly give that consideration. But I don't want to overpromise something that I'm not sure that we'll do, but we'll take a look at it.
It occurs to me we have not talked very much about the policing of something like litter in the city. Is that something your police force has any time for or dedicates any effort to at the moment?
You know, they do a little bit. I'm not going to tell you that they do a lot, but I know some of the officers do that, and they certainly try to remind people, as does the city when we have our clean sweep events that we have and other information that we put out about the importance of not littering. You know, and we run into some of the same problems, quite frankly, at some of the bus stops with litter. And, you know, we've always encouraged people, there's trash cans on the buses. So as you get off the bus, you can put it in, or as you can hold it till you get on and then put it in. And again, that's a good way to do it. Then you don't have all the trash cans out. You don't have the expense of every day people driving around having to empty them and taking that. So, you know, we really do need people to just do the right thing. We all grew up knowing it's not good to litter. Hold it to the next receptacle. And we just encourage people to do that. Our mowing crews all are instructed to pick up litter before they mow, and I think we do a good job with that. Even the mowing that we contract out with private companies, that's part of their requirement, is that they pick up trash before they mow any of those areas, and I think that helps a lot. But we need to encourage people, young and old, just don't litter. Wait till you get to the next receptacle, and it's kind of a personal responsibility thing. Get to the next receptacle and put it away like we've all grown up knowing that we should do.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're chatting today with Lafayette's Tony Rozworski. You can call in your questions at 496-1999. Send emailed questions to ask@WBAA.org or tweet those questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, about an hour after you and I finish our discussion here today, we're both going to be heading down to Reilly Plaza for an announcement about the Hoosier State train service. What are you going to say in your comments?
Well, you know, we're going to talk a little bit today about the importance of passenger rail. You know, we worked very hard here as a local community, working with the other communities along the route and with NDOT, Amtrak, Iowa Pacific eventually, you know, to really save that Hoosier State and to keep that passenger rail service here in our community. You know, we're a growing community. We're a progressive community. We work very hard on quality of life initiatives. We work very hard on talent retention, developing downtown, developing different amenities. And we know that passenger rail, as we look to the future, certainly is an important piece of that plan. Now, certainly that service has to be safe, reliable, on time, have the amenities that we know that people are looking for, like Wi-Fi and food service and some of those things. And so it was a very long, you know, process to reach this agreement between Amtrak and Iowa Pacific and NDOT and the local communities to bring this kind of a hybrid model that we have now for that Hoosier State. And we're going to be celebrating that. And again, trying to bring attention that there has been improvements. I mean, it is more reliable, not always on time, not going to even you know, try to convince you that it is, but it's better than it was. The amenities are certainly better than it was. I think there's a good marketing plan. There's vision for the future, and, you know, we need to continue to highlight that and bring it to people's attention that this is becoming a viable option, and get people to give the train a chance. And, you know, we're doing a lot of work down at Reilly Plaza and on the bridge and on the elevators to keep that area nice for our Amtrak and for the stop of the train there. And we just want people to continue to consider that in their travel options. And we want young people that really want that option, if they're deciding where they're going to live, where they're going to work, where they're going to invest, where they might want to start a business, to know that we have, you know, decent passenger rail service here that can get them back and forth to Indy and Chicago. And so today we're just kind of celebrating that, and I'll be talking about those things.
We had asked NDOT for some numbers, and they actually had some numbers that just came in yesterday that they gave to us this morning, and they show that in May, last month, for the first time since Iowa Pacific took control of the train, ridership was actually up year over year in May. It had not happened since last August when they started being in charge of the train. So I want to know from you, are you more interested in the number of riders that are on the train or the revenue that that train is generating? Because, of course, your community and several others have been paying for a couple of years now to keep this thing going. And the number of dollars has been up since October, but the number of riders finally crested over last year's number this past month. So which of those are you more concerned about?
Well, I don't know that if you can break those out and pick one or the other, because for long-term success, obviously revenue is incredibly important, because we would like to see it over time get to the point where it could be self-sufficient and wouldn't need those subsidies to continue it to operate. But also the number of passengers is critically important, and they're really intertwined, because the goal would be, if you could make the number of passengers and the revenue work and your relationship with the freight rail train so we could get the switching yards and some of the passing areas to work, ideally it would be great to increase the number of daily trains that we have. That's a real, I think, kind of marker in there on how we could get more people to actually use it if you could get more trains. But it's kind of the chicken and the egg, right? You got to get enough people using what we have to even make that viable, and you have to get the revenue to a certain level to create the margins in there that it might be willing to take that risk on another train, knowing that for a while, again, it might take some time for that to build up with ridership, because it is, they follow each other. So
have you, the mayors, been in touch with, say, Ed Ellis, the CEO of Iowa Pacific, about how can we get more trains?
Oh, I've talked to Ed on numerous occasions. NDOT actually asked me to be on the selection committee when we evaluated all of the groups that were looking at possibly being the partner with Amtrak. And so I've talked to Ed on numerous occasions. Everybody understands that more trains is part of the long-term equation to make this a more viable line. So that's been discussed. But
well, so what's the threshold? In other words, what do you have to see, do you think, before more trains are going to become a reality?
Well, I mean, I don't know that we drew some kind of magical number that if we got to this dollar amount that the second train or the third train would be warranted. It was a little bit premature to get to that level of financial discussions when we're just trying to get this off the ground. But if you look at Ed's long-term plan, and he has plans, it involved having some additional trains running that gives people more options when they can leave and when they can get back, that would make it certainly more useful to a larger segment of people. But, I'm excited about today. The lieutenant governor will be here. I'm going to ride on the train from Lafayette just down to Crawfordsville, so not a long trip, but I've got to be back for some other commitments, so it'll be nice. I've seen a lot of videos of the expanded food service and the dining car and what they've done with some of the amenities on the train. So I'm excited, though, to get on the train and to see those, firsthand. Personally, I've received some positive feedback from people in the community that have used it, that they do like the service better. People are friendly on the train when they're serving you and different things like that. So I really feel that we're going in the right direction. It's like most things. It's going to take time, and we have to prove that it's better, and people are going to see continual improvement. But I think if everybody's working together, continue to do that, we're on the right path for success.
We've got about 15 minutes left with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski today on Ask the Mayor here on WBAA News. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for listening to the show. Call in your questions at 496-1999. Send emails to ask@WBAA.org or tweet questions to @WBAA News on Twitter. I had another question from Vincent, a downtown business owner, who says he's a little afraid the city is kind of picking winners and losers as it redoes Main Street. He wants to know why some businesses get patios put in as part of their street is redone, and some are charged to kind of redo the sidewalk in front of their spaces.
Well, you know, the downtown streetscape program has been underway for many, many years, not just the phase that we're doing now, but the other phases that we did around the courthouse and Second Street. And that project has always been where the city funds a piece of it and the property owner is required to fund a piece of it. And there are calculations on how much sidewalk, how much brick pavers the city, you know, pays for the benches and the lights and different things like that. And so that project has always been a financial calculation where there's part city participation and part owner participation. And that's the way that it still is.
Can you tell me just basically, just so I understand, does it cost more to a business owner if they, for instance, want a patio or a bump out than if they just want the sidewalk redone?
Sure. Yeah, there's the calculations because the amount of concrete and what they want, that they're going to end up paying a little bit more for that. And it depends on the exact design and where we're at in the project and how it affects the drainage and all kinds of different things on what we might need to do with engineering. Does their building come out underneath the sidewalk or does it stop right at the sidewalk? There's just it's not quite that simple. There are lots of factors and calculations that go into what those final decisions are, because downtown has obviously been around for a long, long time. So there's a lot of varying conditions in front of each building is a little bit different on what has to be done sometimes. But the bottom line is, you know, we would just encourage everybody to get involved. You know, since the very beginning, we have had numerous public meetings, chances for people to comment, downtown surveys, brought in Hyatt Palma for people to comment. And we still have those ongoing meetings now with downtown property owners that are going very well. We've done a very good job with marketing and communications and getting the word out there. And so there has been many opportunities for anybody that has a question, has a concern, would like to be involved, would like to understand the process, to have come to meetings, and we're still having those meetings. And so we just encourage people to do that. You know, after we get this section done, this is what we could afford to do right now. You know, our goal is to finish all of Main Street eventually. It's been very well received as people begin to see what that finished product looks like in front of some businesses that are done. And it's not a finished product yet, obviously, because there's plantings and trees and some other things, but they can start to see the brickwork. They can start to see the sidewalk. Those bump outs and those outdoor eating spaces, some of those, if you remember, or a caller might remember, it was all covered in the media. We did a big project with Purdue University, and we had Purdue students help design what some of those bump outs might look like, some of those eating spaces in front of businesses that had interest in doing that. You know, DT's Kirby's looked like the outfield of the Cubs, and we're not
sure. Parklets, I think they
parklets and different things like that. And so that was a public process again.
Actually, it happens that the same question asker wants to talk about that. He says he's a little wary of the idea of parking spaces, which he considers kind of a public entity shared among all of the different business owners downtown, being taken up for bump outs for these parklets or whatever. And it's true that sometimes during busy times on Main Street downtown, it can get busy. It can be a little bit tough in some places on Main Street to find a parking space. Do you worry about the amount of parking down there as you think about trying to get more people downtown to see the nice new stuff you're building?
Well, we always take into consideration parking. And I mean, if you look at the design and what we're going to be doing on some of the streets, if you look at the parking that we've created on South Street here recently, the additional parking that we created on 4th Street, if you look at the additional parks we created here recently on Columbia Street, all these areas where there was no parking before, and we've narrowed the lanes and we've created parking places. I mean, we've actually created more spaces than we've had. So we do always take that into consideration. But the idea still is you've got to create a downtown experience. You've got to create a destination, a place of choice that people want to come to. And most people, we're getting better. You know, people will go to Indianapolis or Chicago or the mall, pay a fortune to park and walk for miles to get to an amenity. We're still trying to get where to get people convinced. It's okay if you have to park a couple blocks away and still walk. You know, if you can't get a spot right directly in the front of the building downtown. You know, if you think about how far you walk at the mall to shop. So we're working on that, because the biggest thing we need to do is create those amenities, create those places of choice, that destination for people to come. And I think that we're doing, and that's why downtown is growing and downtown is vibrant. And we have a lot of interest in downtown, and we literally have millions of dollars in private investment being put into downtown right now because people see that. And more and more people are walking to downtown. They're riding their bikes to downtown, and they want a more walkable, bikeable community. And so we're doing all of those things. On top of all of that, and all those areas I just discussed where we've actually created additional parking already, we are commissioning a parking study to be done by a company to look at Upper Main Street as that continues to grow and we see that energy moving that direction. On what should we be doing parking with Upper Main? Is there a spot we should be looking at possibly for a garage, another garage, you know, that we could build a partnership with somebody? So we're looking at that. The city garage is filling up. But, you know, that takes time. That garage has been there for a long, long time. And just in the last few years, is it finally generating positive revenue and getting us to a place where it's not actually taking money out of other funds to be able to operate that and maintain it. And so, you know, parking garages, you got to be really careful how you do those and how you plan for the future. But we have hired a company that are going to help us look at that. So we always look at parking. We take that into consideration as part of the overall downtown development strategy that involves the Wabash River Enhancement Corporation, the bike pedestrian plan, public art, the parklets, the streetscape project. All of those things that make a vibrant downtown, downtown living options, and then the surrounding neighborhoods, like the work we're doing, the Centennial Townhomes and the Centennial neighborhoods, the work that Jeff Ryder is doing off South 8th Street, and, of course, the building that John Schumann put up recently that's a beautiful building off Alabama. So it takes all of those pieces to really make a vibrant downtown.
I wanted to ask you about something that our reporter Sarah Fenton is working on, which is a story about insurance premiums going up around the state across many different types of demographics. And so I thought I'd ask you, as the city is preparing its budget writing for the following year, what are you seeing in terms of insurance rates?
Well, I mean, just to give you a little history, you know, this has been increasing insurance premium has been a huge problem throughout the country for literally decades now, and that's only escalated. When you look at medical trend over the last several years, I mean, many times it is up in double digits, and medical trend is what's used then to help set insurance premium policy rates, things like that. So about 7 years ago, you know, I guess probably 8 years ago, Lafayette and West Lafayette were the first two cities in Indiana. We actually experimented and bought our first set of health insurance together to try to control some of those costs. And then from that, really grew what's called the Indiana Association of Cities and Towns Medical Trust. There were four of us cities that then went together to buy health insurance together to try to help control those costs, to take some of the peaks and valleys, to increase our number of participants that we covered, which gives us also a little bit more buying power. And I'm pleased to say that that really has taken off, and I serve as the president of the IACT Medical Trust here in the state of Indiana, and we have 34 Indiana cities that are buying their health insurance together. And we're about a $50 million trust now. And because we have some additional buying power, we can take some of the peaks and valleys out of that, because different cities have good years, bad years, and we have formulas that we use. We've been able to beat medical trend on most years, not all years, but most years. We had some cities last year that after the banding formulas that we use, you know, they were in the low single digits for increase, 3%. The city's had some single-digit increases also, which really beats medical trend. A lot of people are seeing double-digit increases in their health care costs. So,
any sense what it'll be for this year?
We don't get that number till about October. We try to let those claims run out and get those claims paid right up to the very last minute before we give the municipalities and the towns that are involved that number, because we want it to be as accurate as possible for the next year. And so we wait to the last minute for people to plug that in their budget. We give them a preliminary idea a couple months before, but no, we don't know that. We don't know that number yet. But
what's the biggest increase that you could stomach yourselves without having to pass the cost on to municipal employees?
Well, typically, anything in the double digits, we have to pass on. Even in the single digits, sometimes we make adjustments. It just depends on what the growth quotient is from the state. You got to remember that that money that pays for health insurance goes across many different funds and into the utilities for the utility employees. So, you know, that decision has to be made on what the growth quotient is for the state, which is a 6-year average of income, not counting farm income. And then you have to look at how the utilities did, how COET did, how EDIT did, how other revenue sources. So you can't just rely on, you know, if it's only this amount, we don't have to pass it on, because we may not have to pass it on as much, or, and if it's this amount, if other revenue streams were really good. But even if it's a low increase, if certain revenue streams happen to be really poor for some reason in the city that year, you still might have to pass some of it on. So it really is a significant accounting process that we go through to make those final decisions. But I can tell you this, when we were by ourselves, we had a year that was like 22%, and we would have never been able to – our employees would be paying significantly more for their health insurance than they're paying now, and would not have near the breadth of coverage. We've got a very good plans to pick from, and we have dental and vision, which the city employees don't pay anything for. And so we have very good plans at very reasonable prices, that if we did not belong to this trust and we had not, you know, kind of taken that leap of faith and had the vision to get involved in this about 7 or 8 years ago, we would not be in the financial position that we are now for employees. And we'd be asking, you know, our taxpayers would be putting more money towards employee health insurance than they are now, because it is a big piece of our overall budget.
You mentioned there are 34 cities that are part of this consortium. Are you working to continue to expand that to further shrink those peaks and valleys you were talking about?
Oh, absolutely. We continue to work to get other cities involved. We're continually making presentations to mayors, city council boards. We continue to grow, but we are somewhat selective. Your first rate quote that you might get from us might not be that great, might not even be as good as the one that you have now. But people have to, in a sense, buy their way into the trust. You don't get to just bring, if you've not got good rates and or you've not had good experience, you don't get to bring that bad experience, and we all start absorbing it for you until you've got some skin in the game for a couple years. So we have a process of, for those of us that have been in the trust since the beginning, you know, how people get into the trust. But once you're in and then you've been involved for a while, you really begin to reap the benefits of being part of that, what's a very large pool in the state of Indiana now. But there is a process that you have to work through to get into the trust.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, we'll see you in a little bit down at the Amtrak announcement. And thanks, as always, for your time.
Thanks, Dan.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember that you can find all of our programs archived at our website. That's WBAA.org. And you can send in your questions for next week's conversation with Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes. The email address to do that is ask@WBAA.org. And you can find us at WBAA News on Twitter. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.